People, and welcome to the amazing. Did you hear that? It was like a slur, like I was drunk. Let's try that one more time. Hello, you amazing people out there, and welcome to the amazing Action Comics podcast, where we are all about independent comics. I'm one of your hosts, not inebriated, Angel, with John Pepe.
Whoa, I should be inebriated. How's it going, man? How's it going, all you amazing actioneers out there?
I think they're doing well. But you know what? I figured if I'm going to do it, I'll do it at the very beginning of the podcast, and then I won't do it at all during the podcast. I won't mention your name. I'll just say, look at the guy on the right side of the screen, and then we're good to go. All right, guys. Welcome to another episode of Amazing Action Comics Podcast. This is episode 107. I keep forgetting. I have to go back and look at what episode you actually came on and started, because it's been over a year.
20, like some mid-20s, like 22 or 25 or something like
no,
that.
No, it can't be. There's only 52 weeks in a year.
Right.
Oh, yeah, you know what? We did a couple each, you know, we did, oh, yeah, no, 52. And then we did some where we were doubled up and stuff like that in the week. So maybe, yes, maybe. All right. I'm going off on a tangent already and we've just started. All right. So like I said, welcome to another episode. This is episode 107. But this is a special episode because it's the end of the month, that Thursday, where we actually do an indie movie review from an indie comic. This one we put off because, you know, what's-his-face wasn't around. And so I'm putting it on him. But we do have a comic. We have one comic this week that we're going to review. But yeah, so right before we get on, so we go live at 1:30 p.m. And I send, I can't call you John, man. I don't know why I can't
I
know, do
it's
it.
Hard. It's hard. Do the quotes. It's
so I send him the link sometime in the beginning of the day or whatever it is. And I'm like, all right, here's the link for today. We're going to go live. And it's like 1:25-ish, I go on. I guess it's a good 5 minutes to kind of like bullshit right before we, you know, go live. It's 1:25. It's 1:26. It's 1:27. It's 1:29:30. It's 1:29:50. And the son of a bitch decides to get on and tell me his life story about what happened and why I'm so late.
Whereas, well, now last week was great because I was sitting here waiting. And 1:29, 30 seconds, 1:30. And then I get this text like, oh, I forgot to send you the email. And then today, you were great. You did it two hours in advance. And yes. Then I was the one. So long story short, driving home from work yesterday, I was in a car accident. So it's like a final destination almost. Cause right. I got cut off when that one car accident caused my internet to go off. So it was like creeping at me. And yeah. So now boom, I got hit. I got rear-ended, young high school driver. She just hit those brakes way too late. I was stopped, as someone was in front of me was making a turn. And, you know, didn't even look in my rearview mirror because I'm like, yeah, you know, whatever. Everything's fine. Hear that screech. Hear that bang. Felt a jolt. And I was like, I just got hit. I just totally got hit, you know. And this poor girl, she was mortified. You know, I felt bad for her. I was very calm. It was a rule of thumb. I was fine. Like, if you see an accident and the person who gets out of the car and starts screaming and yelling, they're usually the ones at fault, you know?
Right.
So I was like, hey, you're okay? All right. What happened? You know? And so again, I've been this morning dealing with estimates, and the girl's father, because he's going to help take care of all this. And so, yeah, so that was just sort of occupying my morning. I still have to tape up my bumper because I still couldn't get it done today.
Oh, you can still drive it then.
Oh, yeah. That's fortunately all superficial. Just the plastic bumper at the back of the car. The lights are fine. Car is drivable. It's just half of it's hanging off of the back of the car right now. And I didn't realize this. There's styrofoam. There's actually a piece of styrofoam between the plastic bumper and then the actual metal cushion thing or whatever, which I was very surprised. Wow, there's a piece of styrofoam in my car that's used to protect it. So it did a good job. Hondas are built well ish.
Well, you know what? It's scary because I've been in a few car accidents, and it doesn't even matter if it's 5 miles an hour, 25 miles an hour. One car hits another car. You're driving 2,000 pounds plus or whatever, and as soon as you hit, I've hit somebody in the back before, scary as hell. I've been sideswiped on the highway, scary as hell. And
that's Fast and Furious shit right there.
And you know what's funny is I had just gotten my car. I don't even think it was 2 weeks old, and it's going down 495. So you know when you're going on to the Lincoln Tunnel, there's that curb. There's only one exit before you have to go to New York. And so I get sideswiped. And at the last minute, the truck that freaking sideswiped me decided to exit off. And I was on the ramp to Lincoln Tunnel. So never pulled over or anything. So I had a bump. After 2 weeks of getting in that car, I had a bump for I don't know how many years because I never got it fixed. I was like, there's no way because it's a brand new car. It was going to cost me a couple grand to just fix out the dent.
Yeah.
It wasn't worth it.
It was, this is the first time this happened to this girl, and she was all, oh, this is terrible. I was like, it's okay. You've been driving for a year. Thankfully, it wasn't really bad, but worse things could happen and probably will in your driving career,
So, get him out while she's young. So it's all good. Seriously. As long as everybody was okay. Yeah. I mean, it's scary at certain points. All right. Let's dive into it because we don't really have any news this week. So we can just dive into the actual reviews. All right. So we do have one title for this week. Actually, you know what? I did order another book. It did come in. I forgot to give it to myself, and it actually sold online. So it's Here Comes Calico.
Calico. Yeah. It's like a human cat thing.
Yes. Hopefully I'll get it and then we can review it. So
I did read a second book too, so I could talk about that really quick. Oh, Deep Cuts.
Oh, you did, you son of a bitch. Also, I didn't tell me. I would have put the graphic up for that.
All right,
let's dive into it. So these are titles for the week of 4/26 in the year of our Lord 2023. So let's start with the one that we both actually read. So this one, if you want to kick it off, go for it.
Oh yeah. So, World Tree, from Image Comics, that is the cover to, the main cover, mm-hmm. which, it's still really dark. That cover is still really, really dark. I'll get to that in a second. So this is written by James Tynion IV, illustrated by Fernando Blanco, colored by Jordi Belair, lettered by Aditya Bidikar, edited by Steve Fox, and designed by Dylan Todd. And this is, so first thing, this book was supposed to come out about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and it was recalled by the publisher because there was a coloring error. I believe it was the cover, and the cover had come out too dark. You really couldn't see a lot of the details. So this is the new revised, adjusted cover. Shops were told if they did receive copies to not distribute them and wait for corrected versions. Some shops, I don't even think got the incorrect version. They caught it midway. So the release was pushed back to this week. I gotta say, first and foremost, well worth the wait. This book is pretty damn cool, but terrifying. So James Tynion IV, he is a comic book horror master. He's done, for Image, Department of Truth, which is a huge success. He has done a bunch of stuff for DC, had a healthy run on Batman, but also did a great horror series called Nice House on the Lake. and is currently writing his second Sandman Universe Nightmare Country miniseries called The Glass Onion or The Glass Something. And clearly I'm not reading that one. And he's also doing a great series that I reviewed the first issue of for Dark Horse called Blue Book, which is this first 5-issue miniseries is all about the true life abduction story of Betty and Barney Hill from New Hampshire in 1961. Third issue of that came out this week, and that has been really good, really interesting. Him and Mike Avon Oeming are doing great work on that. But this World Tree is, boy, this is something else, man. This is terrifying. So this takes place in 2024, as it says on the first page, which also begins with a great quote from one of my favorite authors, the crankiest man in all of science fiction, Harlan Ellison. The quote is from, "I have no mouth and I must scream." And the quote is, "Let me tell you how much I've come to hate you since I began to live." Not only is that a great quote in general going into this book, but it really does, I think, if you know Harlan Ellison, it really does describe, I think, him as well. And the reason, really cool thing, the reason why they use, partly why they use the Harlan Ellison quote is your protagonist, the main guy that you're following, is named Ellison. And he has a brother named Gibson. And it is mentioned that their parents were sci-fi nerds. So he was named after Harlan Ellison. His younger brother was named after William Gibson, another prolific science fiction author. And this is really, this is about that weird phenomena of live streaming and people who apparently, you know, I guess this does happen, not to a degree like it does in here, but people who live stream actual acts of violence and in some cases murder, which is not a cool thing to do. And this also deals with a thing called the Undernet. And the hook is that there is this thing in the Undernet that when somebody sees it, it fundamentally changes them. And there are people who are sort of like this cult that are using this to commit murders. And Ellison's youngest brother, Gibson, went on this murder spree. And you see some of it detailed, and he's live streaming it to this Undernet, and it is seen by apparently a very important person in this cult. And the whole thing was you commit these murders, and then you will get this reward in another life. And the way it goes down is really creepy, really effective. Blanco's art is great. The line work is just clean, tight, clear, and really pulls you in. The color palette is really good because you're introduced to another character named Gabriel who, with a flashback sequence that is done in a great sort of like yellowish orange color scheme, you find that he has actually defeated this Undernet in the past with a group of friends from high school. And so now 20 years later, this has resurfaced and he has pulled them together. And that's sort of where World Tree comes in. So there's a lot going on in here. And a lot of it's shocking, but boy, is it good. So yeah, World Tree number one. That's what I'm going to say about it.
Yeah, I have to agree. I mean, I like James Tynion because he's into like all that. He does horror really well, but not like the traditional horror where it's like, you know, just the mindless killing and stuff like that. There's a thought process behind his stories, and there's a really good buildup. And oftentimes he's really good at the payoff. So I'm hoping this does pay off as well. But it's a lot to follow because you did talk about Gibson and his brother Allison. But, you know, they're one part of the story. They're the future part. That past part was Gabriel and his high school friends. Mm-hmm. And they're coming into the mix now because they actually unleashed whatever it was in this Undernet that is being spoken about. And then they thought they actually took care of it and took it offline. We come to find out that somebody else has released it. And Gabriel's reaching out to his high school friends who they haven't seen each other in 20 years, which is crazy.
And that's a great exchange, Gabriel and the one guy that you see them, their communication and how he negotiates. You're flying us all first class. You can afford it.
Right.
You know, like,
right. And it has all those, you know, the tone of, you know, we have to do this because we can't tell anybody because nobody's going to believe all of this going on. And then outside of that, you have this one chick that's just, you know, walking around naked with just the phone. Who just comes to, you know, what is it? Not Ellison, Gibson at the very end, and has that exchange. Now, listen, everything was great because there's a lot of components that are coming in all together. And one of the things that I love about Tinian is that he leaves you with so many fucking questions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
However, there are questions that you want answers to.
Yeah.
And if you know the way that he writes, they're going to pay off slowly but surely throughout the coming issues. So there's a bunch of questions that I have, like, you know, who this chick is, because she did just say like a couple of lines and there's nothing referencing other than that. I love that, you know, that login in the beginning, that, what is it? PH3R, which is fear.
Yeah.
And then she types in the password or whatever is connected to the internet. So there's just something with her. We don't know what's going on.
She's definitely a big figure in whatever this cult is. Like,
right.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Because she's carrying whatever techno virus thingy in that phone and being able to transfer it and stuff like that.
Yeah.
This is the only time that towards the end, and we don't want to give away too much, but the story actually is really good. So if you sort of like this mystery and horror, you know, genre, this is right up your alley. And, you know, if you read Department H, if you read Nice House on the Lake, then you're probably going to like this book as well. The only thing that I could not get over, especially when you're dealing with family, so, and this is the only one thing that I will spoil, so having shot Gibson in front of his brother Ellison and Ellison not to have a reaction, that bothered me.
Well, he does kind of have a more visceral reaction, like at the last page.
Right.
I think he's just shocked and numb, you know, because of how that goes down.
I don't know, but I would have beat the shit out of her. I mean, there wasn't even a yell out or anything. There was just that visceral reaction. I guess, you know what, I guess that is probable and possible.
How she presents herself too. You have a, you know, you, how do you deal with that? The way that she just walks in, Starkers in her birthday clothes, you know, is very distracting in and of itself. Right.
So, yeah it is, but yeah, you hit the nose on the head. I mean, the colors are fantastic. The artwork is wonderful. Everything that happens between the gutters is just left to the imagination. And there's a lot to read, but it's not cumbersome. It's really conversational, and it really flows really, really well. So yeah, Tinian is, you know, he's been doing this for a while, so he has his craft down really, really well.
I think one of his strengths is his character work. His the conversations are very real conversations. These are definitely fully fleshed out people, and I think that draws you in as a reader even more. They're not just stock characters. I mean, he really does a good job of giving people, you know, real personalities, so that when you get this one person, this one woman who just has nothing, you don't know what's going on with her, it really does stand out and makes her even more menacing. Yet gorgeous.
yeah, for sure. And he just has a really good way of, you know, putting a team together that really emphasizes good storytelling for what it is that he's trying to present. Because the tone of the book is just caught really well with, you know, not just the color, but, you know, the way the artist portrays the characters, facial expressions, all of that. Really, really cool stuff. I'm looking forward to this. I wonder how long it's going to be. What's crazy, though, is if you open up the inside where you read the credits, there's an actual address on top.
The worldtree.net. Yeah.
I typed in the address and it goes to worldtree.net.
I was wondering, because they talk about it too. He says how Gabriel says, I kept worldtree.net going for these last 20 years just in case this happened.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I wonder if that's a real site. I should check that out.
But it is. And it just talks about what the book is about, which is funny. So, I like it when they back up stuff like that.
Yeah.
However, what I did find was an error. So if you actually type in the actual address worldtree.net/welcome. Mm-hmm. That page doesn't exist.
It's just, yeah.
Only the worldtree.net. So, yeah. But it was a good touch. It was a fun touch. But yeah, I'm looking forward to the next issue on this. It's off to a good start. Definitely left me with questions that I'm hoping that get answered.
You went to the site. You're not going to go out on a murder spree now, are you?
Who knows? I'll kill you tomorrow. We'll see what happens. All right. So yeah, check it out. Worldtree, number one. This is from Image Comics. You won't be disappointed, especially if you like Tinny and stuff. So really good stuff. All right. So you have another one?
I have another one really quick. It's called Deep Cuts. This is also by Image Comics. This is written by the duo of Kyle Higgins and Joe Clark, who are the ones who are responsible for the Massiverse. You know, Radiant Black, Radiant Pink, all that good stuff.
Does this book fall within that or no, right?
It does not. This is like the furthest thing, okay, I think, from that. It would be amazing if they tie this in down the road, because it's not, I thought it was a one shot, but there's more. So it is illustrated by Danilo Bayruth, pencils and inks. Igor Monti did colors, and the very prolific and very good at his job, Hassan Utsmane Alahu, is doing the letters on this. And this is also an Image book. And so what I think is great, these two books this week from Image really sort of play to the strengths of Image as a company, that you can get something that is just such visceral, present day horror like Worldtree, but then you get something like Deep Cuts, which takes place in New Orleans in 1917 and is all about jazz, and this young boy who plays the clarinet, and all he wants to do is get that shot to play, you know, to play bigger places, you know, and not just carry a guy's trumpet case in a parade, which he does get the opportunity. However, it is in a brothel. Of course, he has to tell his grandmother it's a private club for women only, that he is playing. And I tried to do some research because I was wondering, is this a real thing? Is this a real person that existed? Is he telling a real story? And it doesn't seem like it. Joe Clark, though, is a musician and has played music and taught music, and actually had one of his students, Thaddeus Tukes, actually write down an actual song for this book. So it could do notes and stuff like that. You can probably play that on your own, which I thought was a really cool thing. And yeah, he kind of talked, there's a little text piece in the back where Joe kind of talks about that and the music work that he has done in the last few years, as well as giving a shout out to Thaddeus Tukes' latest album called Let's Vibe. So that's kind of neat that's in there as well. There's also some really cool pages in the back that shows the process, pencils to inks to colors to letters, which I always like when they do that. So you get a lot of good content for $5.99. There will be another issue that is going to feature another musician. You know, again, I believe that this is also a fictional character, but I'm very intrigued by this as well. This looks like it takes place about 10 years later in 1928 for the second issue. This is great. This is basically the young aspiring musician story with the shady mentor who kind of helps get him, you know, take the first steps to that much larger world of becoming a true professional musician. But then you kind of start to see the cracks in that guy's personality, that this mentor, and he does deeply wrong the kid, but he's also wronged some other people as well. And payback really does hit him kind of hard. So you kind of see this guy's fall, and then how it does help the kid to kind of take that next step that he does need to take, because this guy who was posing as this benevolent mentor was really holding him back. So I really, really liked it. It was a great story, complete in one issue. The art was really, really good. The art's really good. It just really captures what I believe, you know, New Orleans back in 1917 was like. But it's also just really good, fluid animation, illustration that really does help drive the story. And you know, again, there's a lot of familiar tropes in here, but they work really well. So yeah, Deep Cuts from Image, I really enjoyed it. This has been a good year so far for music related comics. I really love jazz and I love old style jazz. So I really dug this and what it had to say and how it presented it. And it's really cool because it's like the credits and everything. It's all like an old jazz album and stuff, which I thought was a really nice touch as well. So this is just a really good looking book, really good package. I really, really enjoyed it. That's a great shot there. So yeah, I highly recommend this if you just kind of want something that's not horror, that's not superheroes, that's really slice of life, but really does have a really good story to tell. Deep Cuts, Image Comics, give it a shot.
Nice, check it out. All right, speaking of Deep Cuts here, look, I don't know if you can see this.
Nice, yes,
but,
yes,
but
we
then
know.
Then he apologizes.
He's the nicest guy.
Wait, and then.
Where Cherry Hill Comics at? Yeah, I know, Cherry right? The guy who's like, oh, I'm going to listen. And it's like, what'd you guys do last week?
Oh, my God. Exactly. But yeah, all right, cool. Yeah, you know what? I looked at the book and I was just like, and it just it had two things that I don't like in comics. One, music, because you can't hear it. Yeah. And then two, jazz. I just don't get it at all.
Well, and it was wordy. And it was a historical period piece. Like, so yeah, that was I looked at the first page and I was like, no, Angel's not, this is not
gonna be red flags. all right, cool. So yeah, let's so those are the two books that we had. So definitely World Trees on our top list for this week. So if you want to check it out. And if you want something just a little bit off the cusp, maybe some what do you call that? Deep Cuts. Deep Cut was from Image also?
Also Image, yes. Again, one of the most diverse publishers right now. They do everything, and I love it.
Nice. All right, wonderful. Okay, cool. So we're going to hop right into this one really quickly because we'll have a couple minutes to spend on it. We were supposed to do this around the anniversary. I can actually see the middle figure on your back panel there is the Crow. So yeah. We're going to actually talk about the Crow. So this is the new segment that we started about a couple of months ago, where we take movies that were inspired by any kind of creations. So we've already done Spawn, we did Judge Dredd, yep. And now we're moving on to The Crow. So let's, Phil, why don't you start us off? Just give us like a sort of like a synopsis on what the actual, you know, what Crow is about, and then we'll talk about the differences between what James O'Barr did in the book and what we saw in the movie, and sort of like the tragedy that kind of surrounded that as well.
Sure. You know, I mean, I don't think much really needs to be said about the plot of this movie. This movie came out in 1994 and has really kind of stuck out as a true classic that a lot of people have seen this movie. And it's basically, it's a revenge love story. You know, it centers around a musician named Eric Draven. Right now in the movie, he was killed along with his fiance. And then on Halloween night, and 1 year later, he comes back from the dead, and he is granted this opportunity to avenge their deaths. And the way it plays out in the movie is a perfect structure for that type of story, where you have great, you know, over the top villains, and as he takes them out one by one, he moves further up the ladder until there's the final boss fight at the end. And it's all just done so well. And, you know, at the time when it came out in 1994, I saw it and I said, wow, that's like the best Batman movie that has been made thus far that doesn't have Batman in it. Brandon Lee gives such a great performance in this movie that he really adds depth and layers to this character. And, you know, the way it changes the source material, it's just, I think, near perfect for this movie. But yeah, that's it. It's a revenge love story, and it is full of great action and rooftop running and some really good fights. And again, a performance by a guy who, gosh, if he had, you know, everybody knows he died the year before this movie came out. He was killed on set, a terrible, tragic accident. Mm-hmm. And boy, if this movie, if he was alive when this movie came out, I mean, his career would have skyrocketed. And God, I would have loved him to see, he could have probably played Batman eventually someday if he had survived, you know, because I think he would have been great in that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and it's funny because I believe he had two prior movies to this. So it was Rapid Fire and Showdown in Little Tokyo.
Yep.
And those were really just more action based. And I think that's what they were trying to sort of like pin him to.
Yeah.
And I think he took on the role because he wanted to be able to flex himself and he wanted to be able to spread himself out into a different genre. And even though there is action in this particular film, it really is, it's a dramatic piece because of, you know, everything that emotionally that he goes through, you know, losing his wife the way that he lost her and coming back and dealing with, you know, returning from the dead. And then finding out, you know, he has these powers and then taking ultimate revenge on the people that, you know, took his wife from him. But along the way, discovering, you know, the innocence of life because of the young girl that he wants to protect as well. So, and then I'd never read the material. So until you told me that it was an actual book, I didn't even know.
This is the thing about like that. This is an adaptation that has really eclipsed the source material. So yes. Good point, Jason. And so so many people are surprised to find out, that it was based on a comic. Because this movie is very widely known for good reason and bad, you know, because of his untimely death while making the movie. But the movie is done so well that, it really has stuck in the zeitgeist. It has eclipsed the fact that it is based on a comic. And there are differences, but there are also similarities that are great, you know.
Before you get to it, because we can't talk about the difference in the similarities, right? So I did pick it up. I'm almost halfway through. So here's the thing, because you know what? It's not written traditionally as a comic.
Exactly.
There's a lot of prose to it. And to me, it's a love letter and a suicide letter together at some times. And it's scary and not read like traditional material. So like if I pick up like an action comic or, you know, a big two comic, you know what you're going to get. You're going to get superhero stuff. You're going to get, you know, it felt more real. It felt like there was heart behind it.
Yes.
And I think when you look at material that's being written today, and it's funny because I was listening to something, I listened to a bunch of podcasts, but one of the things that is often being said is that most material being written today, not all, but a lot of material that's written today is almost being written as a pitch for like Netflix or to be picked up as a series or something so that, you know, you can make that extra money. And there's nothing wrong with that, but then there's no depth to the material. Mm-hmm. And you can tell when you're reading something that is written by somebody who is feeling every single word of that page. And then to be able to have that transfer to film and sort of have that same kind of tone to it, I think that's what I got from it because I honestly didn't know. And, you know, watching the movie, I was hooked on Brandon because his father is Bruce Lee. And, you know, I mean, Bruce Lee died before I was even freaking born. But everybody knows who Bruce Lee is. He was one of these figures, especially when you look at when anyone who is first in that thing that everybody knows later on, they're going to be legend in it. Martial arts have been around forever, thousands of years. And now all of a sudden you have this chief person that sort of brought it to light here in the United States. So if you say Bruce Lee to anyone, almost everyone's going to know who he is just because he was the first to kind of like instill what Kung Fu or martial arts is in the U.S. and kind of broke these boundaries. Just like Hulk Hogan would be for wrestling. Even though wrestling was before that, most people know who Hulk Hogan is because he really put it on the map. So you have these people that put certain things on the map. And, you know, growing up wanting to be like Bruce Lee, which is hilarious because I took martial arts when I was younger, but just having that and then having his son, you know, start to be like his father who wanted to be in movies because Bruce Lee wanted to act. He wanted to be an actor. Yep. And, he started in the Green Hornet. We know that the Kung Fu series was taken from him, even though he created it. And they gave it to Derek Carradine because he was too Asian looking for a show.
Not David Carradine.
Bruce Lee. because he was too Asian looking for a freaking a show that was called Kung Fu.
That he was from China in the show.
Yes. So he marries Linda, I believe. I forgot her last name. And so they have Brandon and they have Shannon. Shannon, who's still alive today. You know, still does a lot of work with, I guess, his foundation and stuff like that. And, you know, he had a really promising career. I mean, because he had just done those two movies and then he went out and he did The Crow. And yeah, I think you're right. I think if everything went along the way that it should have gone, he probably would have been a big star right now. And we would have seen him in a lot of things and possibly doing some, you know, big two stuff.
One of the things when I was kind of doing the research for this that I had found on the YouTubes, it's about 2 hours. So I watched it in pieces, but I believe it's called Shadow Play. And it's called the Crow documentary. And really what it is it's just this person took every interview that they could find with Brandon Lee, James O'Barr, as well as like, remember, you know, like those shows like Inside Edition and Hard Copy and, you know, Current Affair. Like when Brandon Lee died, they all did huge segments about Brandon Lee and the death and all that stuff. And then it has, and it puts them in chronological order. So you see this progression in the interviews with Brandon Lee, like you were talking about how he was he talks about what you just said about, the Big Trouble, Little Showdown in Little Tokyo and Rapid Fire. He says, like, look, I did these action movies because I do, you know, I have to get paid to do this work. And what I want to do is I eventually would like to become a big enough star that I can really do more independent projects. So use the money that I would get from a big studio shoot to do something more actorly, less actiony, and independent, and you know low budget, just so I could really show my acting chops. So that was his goal. That was what he wanted to do. And then when you get to these interviews where he's finishing out, you know, he's doing promotion for Little Tokyo, and then he's in there like, "What do you have next?" He goes, "I got this thing called The Crow," and he's like, he gets really excited. He's like, "I play a musician," and he's like, "This is the thing like that's gonna focus on, that's gonna not only do my action, but I get to actually really act in this as well." And he really said like, this is going to be the thing that's going to help me do the stuff I want to do later on. That was his plan. And you know, again, had he survived, that would have been totally, totally true. Totally the thing. And the James O'Barr interview pieces are really good too, because you get one that was done right around when The Crow was about to come out, and then you get one a few years ago at a convention and a couple more in between. So really just some context for people who don't know. James O'Barr was very young, very addictive personality, fell in love with this woman in his late teenage years, then they got engaged, and then unfortunately, she was killed by a drunk driver. And he was left without his fiance, and the driver only got like a 6-month license suspension. So this is a guy who, you know, really tough upbringing, I think was in and out of foster homes, and you know, working odd jobs and things like that, just had all this grief and all this from this trauma. And the only way he thought to express himself was to do this comic book story. And James O'Barr says he was self-taught, and this took him 9 years to do. So like from like the late 70s until the mid 80s, he was working on this. And what the comic is and what the difference between the movie and the comic is the comic is like you said, it is very dark. It is very suicidal. It is filled with trauma and pain. And the format is interesting because, yeah, it's not just traditional comic panels. There are like some other sequences that don't necessarily have panel borders and gutters and are, you know, sort of watercolor. He did watercolor and traditional pencils and inks. It is interspersed with a lot of text pieces, a lot of Joy Division lyrics, you know, a lot of these goth bands that James O'Barr was listening to. And it has a character who the setup is the same as far as, you know, I think they're newly married in the comic, and they randomly encounter a group of thugs. He is killed. She is raped and then killed. And then a year later, or a year or so later, he comes back to life, and it is sort of hinted at that he is just another in a legacy of vengeance seekers. And he is guided by this crow, and he does set off on this path of vengeance to take these guys out. And the big difference between the movie and the comic, it really, I think, is the fact that the murder is premeditated and that you have a big bad at the end. Whereas in the comic, the murder is completely random. And the guy who they put up as the big bad, he's just another thug. There's no leader. There's no real estate mogul trying to buy out the building. And she, the fiance, was fighting against that. And that's why they were, that she was killed. And, you know, and then he walks in as this is happening. And then, of course, he is killed. And what I think is very interesting is that what they were actually shooting when he was, when he died, was that death scene, was that flashback death scene. So I don't know, like our James O'Barr, who says he really developed a brotherhood and a friendship with Brandon Lee. I would feel even more devastated, I think, that the one big tone change, the one big plot change, was the actual scene that led to this guy's death, you know, like, and it was right at the end of shooting. They only had like a couple more weeks left to shoot, you know? And so that to me is like, that is, just adds to that tragedy. And yet none of the, and so while the movie is different, again, and as Jason pointed out, there's a real humanization of Eric in the movie that you don't get in the comic. He is just dark. He, you know, he has, he, because he can, he slits his own wrists and then just tapes them over with duct tape because he is feeling that pain. And it is just cathartic process that James O'Barr is spilling out onto the page. And I think it works well in a comic. As a movie, though, I think it would have been a real tough nut to crack if you didn't do those things in the movie that humanize him. You know, in the comic, there is the little girl, but she's a lot younger than in the movie. We can't let this go without talking about the great Ernie Hudson as Albrecht in the movie, who in the comic is two different characters that they merge together. And in the comic, those characters don't necessarily have that connection that they that Albert has in the movie with Brandon Lee's Eric. And so the movie, the other thing that the movie does really differently than the comic is there is actually a sense of fun that you see him having while doing this, running on rooftops, you know, and laughing. And the one shot in the alley where he takes that hit and he just looks up at the guy and he's smiling. He's like, oh, okay, we're on, you know, really does a good, a lot of the heavy lifting to bring the audience in. And so again, I think that as far as the changes they made, it just made for a better movie. And you add in Brandon Lee's talent and charisma and sense of fun, I guess that is really why the movie has eclipsed the comic as far as public awareness and appreciation. But man, that comic is beautiful and violent and just, for a guy who's self-taught, is really well done. Just the artistic talent that he has, his characters, like the way he draws characters, they feel three-dimensional. There's depth to it. They don't feel flat on the page. And boy, the inventive ways he does come up with to kill these guys is great. And some of that does also make it into the movie. There's a couple scenes that are directly transported from the comic into the movie in a great way. And, you know, it just the best example I think I can make is, so the Crow movie has two soundtracks, right? There's a score, an orchestral score by Graham Revell, which is fantastic. He also scored the Spawn movie. Then there's a soundtrack with music by contemporary grunge, indie, goth bands, you know, from that era. James O'Barr has said basically they all wound up doing songs for the movie because he was friends with all of them and he asked. The only one he wasn't involved with was The Cure, right? The Cure song that they did. And in the album, and it's a great moment in the movie. It's where he's running on the rooftop, right? Mm-hmm. For that first time, the song is called Dead Souls, and the song is originally a Joy Division song, and in the movie, it's covered by Nine Inch Nails. And to me, that's what the movie is a Nine Inch Nails cover of a Joy Division song. That's what the movie is. And I think it works really well for the movie. Even the look, you know, is really sort of updated to reflect the 90s along right. with the music soundtrack. The long hair, that's you know, as opposed to the 80s bangs where he kind of looks like Marky Post from Night Court right. with his haircut in the comic. You know, it just does everything, I think, so well in that movie. There have been attempts at sequels that were terrible. A TV show that was terrible.
Which begs to ask if he still would have been around, would there have been sequels?
Would he have done the sequels?
Right, right.
Yeah.
And that, so. And
I don't know if he, I doubt he would have. I doubt if
yeah,
he would have.
I think so yeah. too. And I think the story itself was just, it was good where it was. And I think because the movie was, that's Hollywood though, right?
Right,
so you got something that's really successful. I'm looking at the budget. The budget was $23 million. And it boxed $94 million.
See, that's insane. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's definitely going to be greenlit for another one, whether we need it or not. As to whether or not the story was going to be any good, yeah. that's something else. And I've seen maybe two times, and then three. I don't think I've ever seen ever in my life.
I have never seen a second, I think, of anything past the first movie.
Really?
I refuse. I just refuse. Same with the comics. There's been a lot of Crow comics that have come out. Even James O'Barr has written some of them. To me, that is like the fly in amber, you know, that comic in that first movie. Yeah. Now they did just wrap production on
a, I know you a, told me and I'm remake. Going like this la 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 la.
So the only things I really have, I have two things to go on as far as I know about this movie. Well, three things. At one point, almost everybody was attached, including most recently Jason Momoa. Jesus. And they all got scrapped. So they wound up with Bill Skarsgård, who is Pennywise from mm-hmm. the It movies. And he's done a bunch of other stuff. He actually does look like a human being. I think he could do it. I think he's got the look. And the only other thing is that, so James O'Barr is still involved. Interesting side note with James O'Barr. James O'Barr made a ton of money off of this movie, right? And he actually had said that he made enough money off of the comics, because the comic was a huge indie success. He made so much money off the comics, he said he didn't need the money from the movie. And he, for years after the movie came out, was anonymously donating the money to adoption causes. And and it wasn't until a few years later that he actually came out and said that. So I think that was really good. And one of the things that he says in one of these interviews that I saw was, he basically was like, if I took that money, I probably would have just done bad things to myself with that money, you know, because of his addictive personality. And so he said, I just thought this was the best thing to do. And he kind of did it in honor of Brandon as well, you know. So the most recent interview that I could find with James O'Barr was probably a few years ago, where he's talking about this remake. And he says that what the intention is to do with this remake is to do a straightforward film version of the comic. So that, you know, sort of 300 style, or Sin City style, using the comic as the storyboard and just filming that. Now, I like the idea. I just don't know how people would respond to it. Because again, as great as the comic is, it is very light on likable characters and narrative, you know. And again, that's why I feel that the you know, what the movie did is building this, you know, taking this story and then building it into a traditional movie trope and narrative worked really well in 94. And so to now go back and just take away all of that stuff from the movie and just film the comic, I think visually it's going to be amazing. I really look forward to seeing them film the guy just getting his legs cut off at the knees while he's standing. But I just wonder how audiences would respond to that. Now, we are in a more cynical, darker age as well. So people might really latch onto it and grasp onto it if it's done well. But I really feel it is, even for me, I think it is a bit of a hard sell. But I look forward to this one. I will see. I will definitely watch this because, again, it's going to be its own thing, not connected to how they tried to franchise it after the first movie in 1994. Which again, like a bad transplant, I just completely reject.
And it was a PG-13, wasn't it?
I think at the time it might have been a PG-13. Yeah, right. I think it would have had to have been. The only thing I can think of it having an R rating is, yes, there is violence,
but it's not like scene like,
yeah.
So I think if he does it the way that he wants to do it, it's going to be a hard R.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. 100%. But the only thing I can think of what 94 would have been R was just the morbid curiosity factor of it. Which again, and that's the thing, man, if the movie wasn't good, it wouldn't have banked $94 million.
Exactly.
It would have had a really strong opening weekend because people would have seen it out of morbid curiosity. But that movie did have legs and was really well in its theatrical run. Because yes, people would go in for the morbid curiosity as far as your general public. But boy, they were engaged and they really latched onto the story. I know so many people are like, that is my favorite movie. Yeah. You know?
Oh no, check this out. All right. So ranked 24 for all films released in the US in 94, the 24th highest grossing film worldwide in 94, and number 10 for R-rated films.
It was R,
released
okay.
That year.
Yeah.
I mean, it was dark. I don't remember anything really that would make it a hard R.
Heroin needles.
Yeah.
Creepy relationship between the big bad and that girl.
Oh my God. Which
yeah, I could see a few things. I could see a few things. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, you know what? It's for the most part, everything that we've done up to now, I mean, this is probably one of the most accurate when you cross over from, you know, material to on screen. And, you know, Hollywood's going to change whatever they need to change to make it Hollywood in that respect. But I think they, for the most part, the soul of the story is there. Like you understand his motives completely, and then everything that's built around that to really push the main protagonist, Eric.
Yeah, finish up.
And then so, but for me, if I didn't know the backstory behind James O'Barr, you would almost feel that something happened to this author. Because it's too real.
It's not.
I mean, even though it's a story, there's a parallel to his life in this story. And even though he didn't do what Eric did, I think what Eric's doing in the book and in the movie is what he wanted to do
100%.
Because of what happened to his fiance. So I think that when you can capture that in your storytelling, that becomes so visceral.
Yeah.
And I think the response becomes so visceral that you connect to the material as well. And I think that's one of the things that when you look at the movie, you kind of connect to that as well. Because, you know, Brandon Lee's performance was great. But I think that character, you know, going through what he was going through, you really feel that pain in that sense. And you feel it when you're reading the graphic novel as well.
Yeah.
It's just crazy.
And the 5-issue initial Crow miniseries was a huge success for a new indie publisher at the time. And it's an interesting story too that James O'Barr has about how it even got published. So he knew a guy at a comic shop who wanted to get into publishing. And I think it became Caliber Press and the guy had I think like 4 pitches, right? And wasn't going to take, he was going to take 3 of them, but wasn't going to take the Crow. Wasn't going to take James O'Barr's The Crow. For those, too dark, it's you know, and I want to sell comics, not burn back stock. And the only reason he went ahead was because the deal at the printer was for 4 books. So he was like, all right, well, I got this 4th one. I'm just going to put this one in there and we'll see what happens. And that was the one that really took off, you know?
Yeah, that's crazy. That's divine intervention right there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And when you're, for me, when I found this, you know, a couple years before the movie was announced, came out, you know, when you're that teenager, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s in high school, and you're starting to, feel pain for the first time, your emotional pain for the first time in your life. And even though in retrospect, you're like, God, why was so dumb? Why was I so worked up over that girl or that thing? You know, at that time, it just, it's so real and it hurts, you know. And that movie hit, like, or that book hit right at the right time for me to grasp onto that kind of stuff. Plus, I was listening to some of those bands as well. So yeah, when the movie came out, I was hyped. I was excited for the movie. And then after the movie, I was like, well, they did change a few things. But then I like, but I was like, but no, I've grown to love this movie. And I really feel that this is quite possibly one of the greatest comic book movie adaptations ever made. Because it has love and reverence for the source material, but it makes the changes that are necessary for it to be an enjoyable movie.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Yeah, guys, if you get a chance to pick up a copy, I mean, it's always going to be in print.
Yeah.
And especially now with another version coming out. I don't know if I'm going to see it. I just have too much love for the Brandon Lee stuff. But yeah, I'm slowly chucking through it. And it's not because it's bad. It's just a lot of it just depresses me.
It's heavy. It's heavy.
Yeah, it's really, really, really heavy, and I have to just read it in chunks.
And you're not in that, like I was saying, like, you're not emotionally, you know, your adult man, 48-year-old father of a child brain is not in that place where it was, where it would have been, you know, when it came out or when you were younger, when a lot of people do find this comic, you know.
Yeah.
So I totally get it. Yeah, going back and reading it, you know, in years later, it's weird. It doesn't grab me as much as it did when I first read it as a kid, and most things don't. But yet the movie is something that I could just pop. I feel like I could pop on at any time and really enjoy the movie. You know, you kind of have to work yourself up to kind of get through the book because there is so much emotion and pain. Yeah.
But you know what? From, you know, an artist's perspective, from, you know, a creative perspective, just the different art styles from one person. In this particular book, for him to change his art style from just inks, you know, to watercolor and stuff like that, and being self-taught through the process. It's just amazing.
Colors are beautiful. And
yeah, it's just a really good masterpiece to look at. So, yeah. I invite you, if you like the movie, I definitely would pick up the book and, you know, have a read through through the source material, and I'm pretty sure you'll love it as well. So,
and then you'll be dressing it all in black and wearing duct tape after that.
And makeup. You'd be like super goth. All right, so that's The Crow from James O'Barr. Hopefully if you guys haven't checked out the movie, definitely check out the movie. I mean, it's 94, but it's still as relevant today, and it's still as beautiful to watch. Fire it up. All the time.
Oh, the best.
Yeah, so definitely, and then check out the book as well. It's always apparent. I'm pretty sure we have copies over at the Joker's Child.
Yes.
Or your local comic shop.
I will say one thing, though, because there's the one thing about the movie, because the musician aspect, I don't think it is even part of the comic, if I remember correctly. I will say one thing about the band that he has in this movie. I get this sense they weren't very good, because we only hear this one snippet of the one song. It's not that good. I think he was a great guitar player. But I also think that the other guys in the band hated him, because you just see one picture of him and like the other guys in the band. Where are these guys? You know, like after the fact, and like, yes. Oh, poor Eric, yes. You know, like I really feel that the band probably sucked in the movie. But Eric was a good guy. So
that was a Hollywood era. That's all good. All right, gang, that's pretty much what we have. I'm going to convince Phil that we're going to do probably Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yes, because I have never seen that first movie.
No?
No.
Oh, you son of a bitch.
And I loved the comic as a kid. I never got into the cartoon because I read the comic when I was a kid, and now I'm older than this cartoon is pitched for.
All right, so let's do that.
We'll do that.
That was 90 something as well, right?
I think 1990.
So we're going to do the 1990 version. There has been an updated version in the year 2000.
I don't care. I want midgets and teenage actors in rubber suits.
You want Ernie Reyes
eating pizza.
So So Ninja Turtles 4 next month. Look out for that as well.
And if you folks have any suggestions for an indie comic adaptation movie that you want us to do, shoot it our way, you know?
Yes, but it has to be an indie comic. Don't give me another Superman crap.
Superman.
So we're all good. All right, wonderful. We're coming to the end of the podcast. So if you like what you're hearing, please subscribe to the podcast. the more people that we got going on that can give us input on how to grow this thing would be fantastic. If you're
or how creator, do you crow this thing? Sorry.
Jesus Christ. if you're a creator and want to promote yourself and or a project that you have coming up, go to amazingactioncomics.com/podcast. Fill out the form. We'd love to have you on. And yeah, talk about you and or your project. Stay up to date on everything that we got going on at Amazing Action Comics by going to amazingactioncomics.com. We still got stuff going on in the works and I'm really excited about. And then, yeah, I was thinking about talking to Len too, but I have like copies and copies of Project Shadowbreed 1 that I could probably just give away on Free Comic Book Day.
Ooh.
So I'm just wrestling around with that notion. So I think it might happen.
Yes.
We'll see what happens. So yeah, I'm just throwing it out to the universe. It might happen. So if you're ever
you could
feel
use
on
it
Jersey,
as a write-off.
I could. Yeah, there you go. For the year 2023, I need one. Please, please, please make sure that you support your local comic book shops. Without them, we wouldn't have the pop culture portion of, you know, this comics medium that we love so much to be out there. So just support your local comic book shops as much as you can by going in at least every Wednesday. And then remember that Free Comic Book Day is Saturday, May 6th, which is not this Saturday, but the following Saturday. And this is where your comic shop just gets a bunch of free comics that they're going to give out to the public. So you might want to ask them what they got going on that day. Definitely at the Joker Shop, we will be celebrating from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Dress up in, you know, cosplay, come out. We're going to have Batman there all day. And when I say we have Batman there, it's not somebody dressed up as Batman. We have fucking Batman there. Dressed
Emmy
up in
the
suit.
Award-winning Batman.
The award-winning Batman.
The only Batman to win an Emmy.
Yes, yes. So, I mean, and he updates his gear
for
whatever current Batman is out now. So I'm really looking forward to what he has coming in at the show. Oh, not the show, at the Free Comic Book Day. So, yeah, come check that out. Phil, where do you get your comics from?
Well, I get my comics at The Joker's Child in Fairlawn, New Jersey. And yes, Free Comic Book Day is coming up and we got our comic book elves, you know, hurriedly putting together these packets of comics for you guys to enjoy when you come on down to the store for Free Comic Book Day. But I know you can't wait till then and you're really jazzed up because we were just talking about the Crow. Well, we got some Crow statues. We got some great Crow action figures, a great Mezco 112 6-inch, which has all the accessories you need, including, you know, not just the crow or the flame thing that he does in the movie as like a base. It's got the cat too, and I love that. And there's even a really little tiny like 3-inch crow as well that you could change parts on and pretend to relive your favorite parts of that movie, as well as all the great comics we have at the Joker's Child. So yeah, come on down, and when we see you, we're gonna fire it up. Fire it up.
Oh my God. All right, kiddos. Until next time, please be amazing, stay amazing, and read something amazing.